Hi, everyone. Delighted to welcome Dr. Swen, a phenomenal philosopher whose work I've followed a ton at Oxford. And today we're going to discuss what got him interested in philosophy, artificial intelligence, and especially achievement. We're a professional network that helps millennials and Gen Z find meaningful work. So achievement is at the core of what we explore. And I think Swen's analysis on this would be very interesting. So thank you very much, Swen, for joining us. Could you tell us a bit about yourself and how did you decide to become a philosopher?
First of all, thanks a lot for inviting me to be on the program. I'm a professor of the ethics of artificial intelligence in the philosophy department at the LMU Munich, Ludwig Maximilian University in Munich in Germany. How did I get interested in philosophy? I mean, I guess like a lot of people who are interested in philosophy and do it professionally. I guess I was interested in philosophical questions before I knew that there was such a thing as philosophy. I mean, I remember I was interested in, I'm still am interested in music and composition and songwriting, etc. And I guess one early philosophical thought I had was, okay, well, before you write a song or create a piece of art, I mean, there's a sort of the possibility of writing that particular piece of music or creating that particular piece of art, the idea of it, so to speak, in a certain, the possibility already exists. And so the question is where and in what sense? I mean, it's a little bit like the Platonic idea of forms and the manifestation of reality. So those kinds of questions about things that don't yet exist but are possible that could come into existence were interesting to me when I thought about music and art but before I got into philosophy. But when I was in school, there was I took the first possible philosophy course one could take, as one progresses through one's education. I don't think I understood what it was, but I did get a good grade in that course, and I had a very encouraging teacher. And so then, when I went on to the university, I first studied some music and musicology because, again, I'm quite interested in music. But then I also thought, okay, well, I didn't get a good grade in philosophy earlier on, so maybe I should try a philosophy course again. And then I was encouraged by my teachers, basically, and I got more and more interested. And then you mentioned that you studied at Oxford. I mean, we read the Oxford philosopher Derek Parfit and his book Reasons and Persons, and I guess that's what really got me hooked and thought and made me think that, yeah, I really want to be studying more philosophy. And I mean, so he has that book is about, I mean, it has four different parts. I mean, one of the parts is about personal identity and what it is to be a particular person existing over time. And if you look into the past and the future, there might be a person in the past and the future that's you. And what exactly is the relation between you and that person? Is it the same body, the same mind, some sort of combination of the two, etc.? That at that particular point in time really got me hooked on philosophy. Now that's pretty far from what I do today, the ethics of AI. I guess I first got into ethics and then later into AI. And in addition to Parfit, I mean, another philosopher that everyone studies is, of course, Immanuel Kant. And I remember the first time I heard this idea that, treating humanity and each person as an end and never as a mere means. I guess I was very inspired by that because it really resonated with me. But then, you go to the next philosopher, maybe Jeremy Bentham, the idea of promoting everyone's happiness. That also sounded great. Or Aristotle, trying to become a better person, develop human virtues and flourish as a human being. That also sounded great. So I guess early on, I'm more of a pluralist when it comes to ethics, as opposed to someone who thinks that, ethics consists in one and one only goal. And that's, for example, just maximizing happiness. That's the only thing that ethics should be about. I think, human life is complex. And so human ethics should also be complex. So I got into ethics, but then, really fast forward a long time to after I was done with my dissertation. I did write about Kantian philosophy in my PhD work at University of Michigan. But then, in my first job when I was a postdoc, in my teaching, I had two sort of instructions. You have to teach ethics courses, and one of the courses every semester has to be in applied ethics, practical ethics. And then I thought, okay, I'll teach something to do with technology and in particular human enhancement, because that was one of my old teachers, Ingmar Persson, who actually was part-time in Oxford before he retired, working with the UHERO Center for Philosophers, had written a book about the idea of enhancing human beings with technology. So in a certain sense, that's, since one of my teachers had worked on that, I got into this topic. And then my next job was at a technical university, the Eindhoven University of Technology. And there I really thought I should work on something to do with technology. And at that time, I mean, this is almost 10 years ago, the idea of self-driving cars was sort of a really hot topic. I mean, if you work on AI and ethics like I do now, everyone is talking about large language models and generative AI. Back then, everyone was talking about self-driving cars. So I wrote one of the, I didn't write the first ethics article about that, but I wrote one of the early ones about the question about, you know, is this a sort of a real life trolley problem? If you're a philosopher, you know what I'm talking about. There's a classical philosophical thought experiment about a train that's heading towards five people that are, for some reason, are on the tracks. And then you are standing next to a switch and you can redirect the train and onto another track. But there's one person there. And so should you sort of sacrifice the one to save the five? A lot of people say yes. But what if you have to push someone in front of the train, thereby killing them, but setting off the automatic brakes of the train in order to save the five? Here, suddenly, a lot of people say you shouldn't do it. So sometimes we think you should save five by sacrificing one person. Sometimes you shouldn't. The means you take to sort of sacrifice the one matters. Anyway, that's a classic discussion in philosophy. Now, all of a sudden, people were saying, well, what if it's a self-driving car? Somehow the brakes are not working. It's heading towards a group of people. And so the self-driving car can be pre-programmed to react a certain way in such a situation. Should it sort of go in another direction? Well, what if there's another person there? You know, what kind of principles for emergency situations should self-driving cars have programmed into them? That was a really hot topic about 10 years ago. And so I started writing about that, and I really got into that whole idea, like, okay, so if we have machines or technologies with not human intelligence, but artificial intelligence making decisions that affect us and our lives, well, very quickly you can see that there are sort of interesting philosophical and ethical issues. And that's how I sort of went into ethics and AI. And then, I ended up eventually here this year, actually. I'm the first professor of the ethics of AI at my university. Like many other universities, new professorships have been created in this field because there's kind of society-wide recognition, not just self-driving cars, but again, things such as generative AI, decision-making systems that are making diagnosis of medical problems we're having, that are making recommendation treatments. You know, when it comes to hiring people, firing people, we rely increasingly on computers to tell us whom to hire, whom to fire, etc. So that's really fascinating. And lots of universities, I mean, you mentioned Oxford, where you studied. There's a new center for the ethics in AI, I think it's called there, you know, hiring lots of people. And so all over the place, this whole topic of the ethics of AI has completely exploded. And so I did get into it a little bit before the explosion, I'm glad to say, but definitely now, you know, a lot of people are interested in it. So anyway, that's a very long explanation of how I got to be where I am now.
But much needed. I'm sure it was, you know, it was a path with lots of twists and turns. People say that so much happens in the world of AI every day. I used to work at Microsoft before starting Network Capital. And every day something changes.
It's hard to keep up with.
It's hard to keep up with. As a philosopher, what does change mean? Like how do you look at news, or say a new paper being published in the field of AI? How do you process that information and change the way you look at it?
Yeah, no, I mean, it is, as I said previously, I'd been working on more historical philosophy, like the analysis of Immanuel Kant's works. And of course, there things move very slowly. I mean, he died 200 years ago. People are, since then, have been writing papers about his philosophy. But, you know, it takes a very long time for some new idea or some new interpretive suggestion to come up. In AI, on the one hand, you have a technological development. And as you said, every day some new type of chatbot comes out, or some new form of technology, some new like twist on machine learning, etc. On the one hand. On the other hand, so many academics, whether it's philosophers, whether it's psychology studying people's reactions to AI, are doing research and publishing. So keeping up is indeed very hard. I am an associate editor of a journal, so I, you know, get to see a lot of the research in progress, but, you know, by handling submissions to our journals, Science and Engineering Ethics, on AI. And so that's one way of keeping track. But just kind of, you know, you have to do a lot of reading. You have to go to a lot of workshops and conferences, and just keep in touch with your colleagues so that you don't sort of miss out on. On the one hand, you also have to check what's happening in the world of tech. And so, plus what our, you know, colleagues are thinking about. My university and many other universities are also working in a kind of interdisciplinary way. So we're trying to collaborate across sort of interdisciplinary boundaries, so to speak, to sort of, because actually a lot of people working on the more technical side, computer scientists, engineers, they are also getting interested in these more social and ethical issues. And so, we're just trying to catch up with everything, keep up, and so much interesting stuff going on. It's a bit of a challenge to keep up with the latest.
Yeah, I can imagine it's a challenge for everyone.
Yeah.
But for me, the most fascinating part of your research has been the wide areas of applications it had. When I was researching Brian's book, Brian Arp, who's a friend of yours, studying the intrinsic value of love and, you know, your critique of why some of the love drugs don't work, to looking at achievement, to looking at responsibility in the case of AI. It's fairly, you know, contemporary questions that really are important when we think of it. So I imagine that you have a wide range of interests. How do you weave them all together? And this will really help our members of our community think of framing and forming multidimensional careers. That's the reason I ask.
Yeah, in a certain sense, this brings us slowly but surely to the topic of achievement and sort of, you also mentioned human responsibility, because I mean, the very idea of AI, well, I mean, I should say AI, the term was introduced in 1955. And since then, you know, whenever new technological development, people want to redefine what AI is. You know, at one point it was rule-based systems, then, you know, machine learning, hybrid systems, and so on and so forth. But all the while, there has been this more general idea of creating a technology that can do something or take over a task that humans were previously performing using their intelligence. So let's say writing a text, making a medical diagnosis, even driving a car requires practical intelligence. All of these things we do using our, you know, human skills and intelligence, and now we're creating computer programs that can do these things that we would otherwise do using our intelligence. Now, that very idea raises questions. Well, if I'm handing over a task that was previously performed by me and that required me to use my intelligence, that was maybe an important responsibility on my part, that maybe required me to develop special skills and to distinguish with myself, perhaps. Now I'm giving that over to a computer program. So the question is, okay, what am I supposed to do now? Maybe I can do something else that requires even more intelligence, even more skill, and it is an even bigger responsibility. That would be a nice scenario. But what if that task is now handed over to a computer program, and then the next task, and then at some point, the question is, what is there left for me as a human to do? Am I going to be passive, just taking in recommendations, entertainment, suggestions, etc., from, you know, AI computer programs, or, you know, what's my role going to be? So now that's a somewhat exaggerated scenario. I mean, there's a movie, WALL-E, I think it's called, you know, depicting a future where these humans are just sitting and sort of watching movies all day, and they're completely overweight because there's nothing for them to do but to sit and eat and watch, you know, light entertainment. Now that's the kind of scenario that maybe wouldn't seem like a scenario in which those particular humans are, you know, having a lot of opportunity for achievement, maybe even for, you know, meaningful relationships with other people where you do, you know, difficult things and meaningful things together. You just sit there, do nothing. So that idea of sort of creating technologies that take over the kind of work that we would otherwise do using our skills and intelligence. I think that's one thing. And then the question is, you know, when is that a good thing? And when is that maybe something that creates problems for us? That's the one sort of basic question that sort of ties a lot of the things that I'm doing together. Whether it's the idea that you mentioned of creating drugs that would sort of modulate our emotions. And so instead of kind of working on our relationships by, you know, putting in the time and the effort, so to speak, we try to think, well, could we somehow stimulate our neurochemistry with drugs or treatments? Which, I mean, it could be a great idea in some circumstances, but you would certainly change, you know, what it means to have these kinds of emotions, the circumstances under which you develop these emotions and these attachments, etc. So, of course, Brian Earp, as you mentioned, has done a lot of it, fascinating work on that, some of it together with Julian Sebelescu and other co-authors. And I mean, Brian and I have also written some things about this together, but it's part of this bigger topic of, you know, giving over tasks to technologies that previously required human effort, human talent, human intelligence, human emotion in that particular case. And then the question is, okay, how does that change the way that we understand ourselves, the way we understand the work we do, or maybe we don't have to do any work because it's taken over by the technology. So what am I going to do now? You know, how can we make our lives meaningful, fulfilling, and so on and so forth. So that's the sort of thing that sort of ties a lot of my work together. And then you can kind of focus in on different aspects. I mean, we mentioned self-driving cars. If I'm not driving anymore and I don't carry out the kind of responsibilities that a driver has, you know, who's going to be responsible if there's a crash? You know, who has a duty of care to try to make sure that other people's safety is ensured? Well, if I'm not driving anymore, why is it my responsibility? Or, you know, if you do work, it may be legal work, you know, you're looking at old cases and you're trying to think about how they relate to the case that's currently being, you know, evaluated. Well, that's something that you maybe can hand over to a computer that could read, so to speak, the old case law and then make recommendations. And so maybe I now only have to approve of a suggestion made by the computer. Of course, that might be convenient, but on the other hand, sometimes having to do all that reading, having to process all that information can be part of what makes you really understand and get it. Also develop intuitions. And so sometimes we think of something like having an intuition about what the right thing to do is as a kind of magical power, but it's also something that, you know, if you work a long time in a particular field, I mean, it can be you're an athlete, you know, you develop a kind of bodily intuition for, you know, how to move your body in order to, you know, I don't know, score a goal or, you know, hit the tennis ball or whatever it might be. It becomes automatic, but it's because you've trained yourself. In the same way, you have to train your mind to kind of develop intuitive judgments about, you know, what's the right path to go, you know, if you're, you know, working law or you're working medicine, etc. So there are these questions about, okay, so maybe it's convenient and nice for us to be able to hand over a lot of boring work to AI, but maybe that boring work is part of what trains us to do well, you know, when it really matters. And so anyway, yeah, as you can see, I mean, for me, it really opens up a lot of questions, this idea of giving over tasks that we otherwise would perform to technologies.
From love to artificial intelligence. Actually,
absolutely.
That's really important to have a core question and then redirect your interests accordingly. Yeah. I want to talk about achievement today because, as I mentioned, it's central to Network Capital's existence. Essentially, we're a career development and mentorship platform for what we call kind and ambitious millennials. So achievement is something that a lot of us try to be part of. So do you want to tell us what is achievement and why should we care about it?
Yeah, so maybe I'll start with the second part of the question. Why should we care about achievement? Well, on the one hand, a lot of people do care about achievement. And so, of course, you can then ask, you know, is this a mistake? I mean, some people even argue that we should care less about achievement and focus on other values instead. I don't take that view. I think that we're right to care about achievement. Why? Because I think it's one, but not the only thing that makes us experience a sense of meaningfulness, whether it's in work or in life in general. If you feel that you have achieved something, maybe in your relationships with the people around you, or maybe in the workplace, or maybe even if it's a project that you do sort of on the side of your work as a sort of hobby, then that will often, you know, if you feel that you're making progress and you achieve something, that will often give you a sense of, on the one hand, satisfaction, but also a sense of doing something that's meaningful. That's, you know, you've devoted yourself to something that's worth doing. And like, yeah, so it's part of, I mean, more broadly, living a meaningful human life. And then maybe if it's achievement in the context of your work, having a meaningful form of work. Again, I don't want to say that's the only thing that makes work or life meaningful. I think, again, as I said before, I'm a bit of a pluralist. I think we should think in terms of the complexity of human life. When it comes to work, for example, having good, being part of a team that's a good team and has, you know, good collegial relationships, that can be another thing that can make work feel meaningful and be meaningful for you. Having the opportunity, and in a certain sense, this is related to achievement, to develop skills and excellence, you know, in your line of work. That having a certain amount of autonomy so that you can shape the work to some extent that you do, that is also very much for a lot of people correlated with the sense of doing something meaningful, as opposed to just being told what to do at every step on the way. Being, you know, having someone that bossing you around all the time, that will typically be seen as less meaningful kind of work than if you can shape the work you do. So I think achievement is one of those components of work that is meaningful, and then perhaps even more broadly, living a meaningful kind of human life. So that's why I think we should care about it. Now, the question, of course, you also mentioned is, well, what exactly is achievement? Well, I mean, this is actually, I mean, we have a sense of when something is achievement, but sort of breaking that into down into parts, it's not so easy. I mean, for example, does an achievement have to be something that's valuable or morally good, or could something that's actually not particularly valuable or not even particularly morally admirable, could that count as an achievement? Let's say, for example, and that's one question, like, you know, does it have to be something that's sort of good in some way? Second, does it have to require that you perform better than other people, than your peers? Or should you compare, your putative achievement with what you yourself could do in the past? And like a small child learns how to tie their, you know, their shoelaces or something like that. It wouldn't be a great achievement if if when you tie your shoelaces in the morning, something like that, that's, you know, we don't count that as a great achievement, but maybe when you first learn the skill. Or let's say that you have a terrible accident, and so now, you know, it's very difficult for you to use your hands. Or you have a stroke and learning to speak again or something like that. That could be, so to speak, an achievement relative to where you are at the moment. Regaining that skill or learning it for the first time. So that's, you know, on a very local level, an achievement for you. But if you start comparing yourself with your peers, then maybe in the workplace and you're fully developed, highly skilled adult human being, let's say, then maybe in that context, an achievement is something where you kind of, you know, go beyond what is expected of you. And maybe, let's say that, you know, you're working in a tech company trying to develop the newest form of AI, and you know, you are the one that has that key idea that helps to take the research on that further. And then, you know, then maybe that's an achievement in your context. So it's a little bit, I think, context sensitive, and also in terms of what are you comparing, what you were doing with. Are you comparing with what you were able to do before, or are you comparing what you're doing with other people, your peers? And an achievement at least seems to be, you know, you're moving one step further in some sense relative to what you were able to do before, or relative to maybe what you and your peers were able to do or have been doing before. I think those are some of the things we associate with the idea of achievement, but I think there's more. It's one of those ideas that are actually quite rich, and, you know, they can sort of, if you think about it much longer, you can tease out other kind of associations that we have when we think about what exactly qualifies as an achievement.
So there are two views, it seems like. One seems to be Bradford's view, which looks at competent causation and the minimum amount of effort required to complete something. But there's another view, which seems to be the practice-based view. And I think you've looked at both in your critique. Do you want to briefly tell us what is the fundamental difference between both of these approaches? And how does that sort of change our analyses when we look at collaborative displacement or other things?
Bradford has this idea that an achievement involves bringing something about, creating a certain result, making something happen, so to speak, in a way that involves your using a certain skill and sort of you're playing a key role in the causal chain that leads up to that. The thing happening. I mean, it doesn't have to be that you're the only person. So maybe you and I together build a house, let's say. So it's a joint achievement because our work is both sort of necessary in order for that the house to be built, let's say. If I, however, step away and you keep working on the house, then maybe the part of the achievement that I'm involved with was maybe laying the foundation, let's say, but you did the rest of the work, so I'm no longer involved. So, that whole idea of achievement is that you have to put in some work, you have to do something that makes a difference to the end result. Again, it can be anything from tying your shoelaces to building a house in this example. But you're doing something has to be involved, and there has to be a non-accidental relationship between the end result and what you were doing. Of course, it could be that you slip on a banana peel and then you fall into a swimming pool, and then people laugh, and then it's a humorous event. But is that an achievement on your part? Well, according to Bradford, it's not. I mean, you're involved, but not in a kind of intentional and skillful way. So that's the one view. The other idea, well, I mean, it depends. I mean, sometimes when people talk about participating in a practice, they maybe use the idea of achievement as a way of framing that, or they think that maybe we care too much about achievement. Maybe we should look at what kind of practices are we involved with, what kind of teamwork are we doing with other people, and maybe we should look for meaning in the workplace, not so much in terms of the end result and what we bring about, looking at who achieved the most, let's say, but rather who puts in the work, who shows up every day, who gets into the spirit of things and takes a sort of non-instrument, like if you do, I'm just there to make money. I show up every day because I promised someone, but I really don't want to be there. I put in so much work as necessary, but I really my mind is elsewhere, let's say. That's not a very, from that point of view, very meaningful way of showing up at work and doing the work. It's like doing the minimum but not really getting into it. A meaningful way of engaging in a practice, according to that way of thinking, is to kind of be there, focus your mind in on whatever you're doing, really take it seriously, and perhaps maybe you're a researcher trying to develop a new medicine. Maybe in the end your team didn't succeed, but you're part of the practice, and maybe it's necessary for there to be many teams working on the same project. Separately, perhaps trying out different possibilities, and then it could be that my team just didn't happen to be the one that had the breakthrough, but maybe there had to be all these different teams trying out the different possibilities. And given the fact that some team or other or someone is going to have achieve the goal, maybe that makes even the work that I did meaningful, even if I wasn't the one that sort of competently caused the outcome, to talk in Bradford inspired terms. So those are two different ideas. Again, I personally would want to say that I don't think we have to have a choice. Like, meaningful work is either one or the other. I think one dimension of making your work meaningful might be this idea of showing up, putting your mind to it, really getting into it, into the spirit of things, so to speak. That maybe that's one dimension of what it is to spend your life in an intentional, meaningful way. But then, of course, if you then achieve the goal that you're working towards, you do develop that drug for whatever, or like the vaccine for the next pandemic that comes along, whatever it might be. Of course, that's a wonderful achievement. And that might make, you know, that might add another layer of meaningfulness to the work you're doing. And then, of course, as you already hinted at, as you raised the question, well, let's say that there's less work that we have to do because we can now sort of outsource some of that to our the wonderful technologies that we're developing. Then maybe there's less room for human achievement. Well, the human achievement may be displaced elsewhere. So maybe the achievement now is the ability to create these computer programs that can then do other kinds of work for us, such as, you know, trying out different possibilities, making different kinds of suggestions. Well, the person who previously was in charge of trying out those possibilities, doing the background research, whatever, the question is for them, you know, what are they going to be doing now? What's their new role going to be? And maybe there will be less room for achievement for them because perhaps a computer program can do at least part of their work better than a human is able to do. Of course, for any task where people start saying that computers can do things better than us, there's always a discussion to be had of whether that's actually true. I think it's often going to be the case that there's a particular aspect where, you know, the computer program is going to outperform the human, but most activities that we're involved in actually, you know, are broader than one small aspect and often requires actually more than one person. I mean, many things that we achieve in life, to go back to achievement, even though we might sometimes credit a particular person, we hold them up and say that, like, look, this is the person that should get the Nobel Prize or whatever it might be. Very often there's a team behind them, and they're, you know, they're depending on, you know, their team members, other people's previous work, et cetera. And so sometimes when we think that computers can take over tasks and there's nothing for us to do anymore, I mean, philosophically speaking, it's interesting to think about the extreme case where there's really nothing for the human to do. But realistically speaking, often the difference is that the human now has to do something slightly different. They maybe have to retrain themselves, you know, excel in some other domain or whatever it might be. That, of course, can already be quite disruptive. That, you know, do we really want to change the kind of work we're doing? Does it, is it going to give us the same sense of, I mean, a lot of lines of work have a certain sort of, I don't know if the identity is the right word, but it's a certain sense, like, you know, I am a university professor in my case, or, you know, maybe I'm a, actually, at one case, the Paris Metro at one point automated the, so they basically had self-driving trains, so to speak. And then the job of the person while driving the train was mostly to sit there and observe and then maybe intervene if there's a problem. And a lot of them actually felt that even though they had a lot of responsibilities, but that, like, just the driving of the train, like, that's what some people liked and what they felt that they're, like, they were really making a difference. Now, sitting there having the train drive itself, for a lot of them, it was frustrating. So anyway, so yeah, achievement, it's a wide concept. There are many aspects. We often exaggerate the role of a particular human. At the same time, we do want to be that human that is held up and, you know, and credited with you know, the achievements. Because I mean, one thing that I mentioned before, that we do value achievement, a very closely related thing that we also tend to care about. I mean, sometimes people care too much about this, is getting credit when, you know, when, well, when we deserve it. I mean, of course, this, going back to Aristotle, I mean, there's this discussion about the good man, I mean, the good person. I mean, back then it was talk about the good man, but the good person, I think we should say, is someone who wants to be honorable, not just to be honored, and not just to get credit, but to be, you know, to be praiseworthy and to be honorable. I mean, and yeah, since the achievement is partly connected with this thing about being getting recognition from your peers, having opportunities to distinguish yourself, and again, if you're a good, virtuous person, to get that credit when, you know, you're really praiseworthy, you really did something well. And this is another dimension for why we should maybe worry to some extent about handing over too many tasks to technology and AI, namely that we might leave less room for ourselves, on the one hand, for achieving things, but on the other hand, for deserving credit. Because, I mean, the less I have to do, the less intelligence I have to use, the less effort, the less skill, because now that the AI, the technology is taking over things, the less I sort of take away the conditions that are usually the criteria for deserving to praise. I mean, let's say that instead of writing my philosophy papers, you had read some of them, you said before, I ask, you know, let's say ChatGPT or Bard or one of these programs, why don't you write a first draft? And then I go in and edit things a little bit. And then I find that actually the latest version of this large language model is really good at writing philosophy papers. Now I have to do less editing. And I minimize my own role in the production of my new philosophy papers. Well, if I do that, I mean, so far it's not really possible because the outputs, I tried this actually together with Brian Earp, and we tried to write a paper using ChatGPT, but at that point in time, it mostly produced generic and not very interesting material. So you can't really do it yet, but you know, it's getting better and better. And maybe the smaller we make our own human contribution to those papers, you know, why should I get, you know, I don't know, the research award or promotion at my workplace? Because I'm actually doing less, even if the result is equally good. But this is another reason to kind of think about the philosophical aspects about this. People do want to achieve things. They want to be to get credit, to get recognition for work that they do. But you know, AI is all about minimizing the role for the human, maximizing the role for technology, and yeah. So thereby we might give ourselves less, fewer opportunities to like really distinguish ourselves. So, anyways, that's certainly part of what I'm fascinated by at the moment.
Yeah. Oh, this is fascinating. It does strike me that effort, creditworthiness, these seem to be important considerations for humans to think of achievement. But I also, one aspect of my life is technology, startups, innovation, etc. And there, it seems to be that there are no marks for working extra hard. I mean, it's sort of, you have to because, you know, you have to get stuff done. But in the case of, say, PayPal, a financial services company, they got a large chunk of their users by realizing that why do advertising when you can actually pay people money to use an app? So they gave people money, people started using an app, and that's how they found a certain amount of traction. One way of looking at this would be, hey, that doesn't sound to be an achievement. You're paying people to use something. But in their head, it is an achievement. You're spending much less than you would have spent on marketing to achieve a certain outcome. So when you consider the world of innovation and startups, maybe effort and creditworthiness gets further complicated. I'm not sure if you have any thoughts on this space.
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, like that and similar cases, of course, it's partly a matter of coming up with creative ideas and putting things in terms of achievements. I mean, the achievement there might be to come up with this new business model or this new solution to an old problem, so to speak. So I mean, that would, I think, be a classic case of sort of using your human intelligence to solve a problem. And there, you might then later create a situation where there's less effort needed. But solving the problem and creating that situation where less effort will be needed, that was an achievement, and making use of creative human intelligence. Of course, the problem would be if we do that too often, so that, you know, from now on, we can sort of just sit back and, you know, watch Netflix all day, which might be enjoyable, but after a certain amount of time, frustrating. So, of course, then the response to this, of course, would be that, yes, in theory, you could imagine a kind of situation where there are no more problems, nothing for us to do. In reality, however, there are, I mean, it's good in one way because it gives us a challenge and it gives us room for achievement, etc. But sadly, in another way, because there's so many problems in the world, there's so many diseases, there's so many people everywhere, and they're, you know, we are using up all the resources and, putting a lot of strain on our natural environment and the climate, etc. So there's no shortage of problems for us to work on. However, there might nevertheless be a situation where, because there's so many of us and we can't, well, maybe we could all be engineers and computer scientists, but there's going to be a lot of people that, you know, what are they going to do with their time? I mean, with their skill sets, maybe you know you maybe you went through many years of education, and suddenly the thing that you really learned and to excel at, that thing was now automated. So you have to retrain, and then by the time you're done with your new training, maybe the new thing has also been automated. So anyway, I mean, one question is it the case that for each single person, there's going to be no challenges and no opportunities for, you know, for using their skills? Probably not. I mean, most likely there's going to be always be a subset of people, you know, who have a lot of work cut out for them and where they can use skill. And of course, maybe once they solve a certain problem, then maybe they have to find another problem to work on because that's already been solved and it can, well, maybe can be improved. However, there might be a lot of other people for whom it's harder to find something meaningful to do, a meaningful type of work, especially if they have spent a lot of time in a particular kind of job that now is, you know, it's more cost effective to like to have the computer take over that particular kind of work. So I mean, this question about like, are we talking about each single person? Are we talking about majorities? Are we talking about large subsets of the population? And maybe depending a little bit on, you know, what we're talking about, these worries about less room for human achievement, less room need for certain kinds of human skills are going to be bigger or smaller problems.
This is fascinating, Sven. But haven't we gone through this script before? Every time there has been some new wave of innovation, people are quite worried that it's going to take away jobs, leave people, you know, not having much to do. Is there something very different about this new wave of AI, or is this time, is it really different? Just like when ATMs were invented, the biggest fear was that bankers won't have any jobs. When computer came into being, people were like, oh, you may not need people to do financial analysis of any sort. But it doesn't seem to be the case.
Yeah, well, I mean, this, absolutely, that's a great question, and actually a question that comes up quite a bit. And it's fascinating to look at what, you know, people like myself say about this, and people researching the present state of AI and technology, and also looking into the future. And certainly there are lots of colleagues, including very influential people working on AI, who really do think that it's different this time for the reason that they say, and I mean, I'm personally skeptical about this. They say that, well, actually, the technological development is going so fast that quite soon it's going to be very hard to find a type of work that couldn't be done better by, you know, some form of AI technology. Whereas in the past, it was the case that, yes, every now and then there's a technological development so that we don't need a certain skill anymore, but there's always like a very long list of other types of things that humans can do very well and that technologies can't do. So some people claim that that's changing because it's you know, we're getting to a point where AI, robots, technologies can just do like across the board things better than humans, or soon that's going to be the case. Again, I personally, I'm somewhat skeptical, at least that we will get to that point anytime soon. I mean, of course, if you still think that they're going to be humans, let's say 2,000 years from now, you know, unless, you know, the planet is no longer inhabitable, etc., or there's like some sort of natural catastrophe, there are no humans. So let's say that we survive and we really go very far into the future, then, I mean, then perhaps anything is possible. I don't know. But in the shorter term, I think, you know, actually, when you look at, I mean, it's very fascinating. Like, the technologies, there are certain things that they're really bad at and certain things they're really good at. I mean, let's say one example that people always use is cutting hair. That might seem like, yeah, I mean, it's not that it's by no means a low skill form of work, but it's sometimes thought to not require much, let's say, intelligence. However, it's extremely hard to build a technology. And I mean, I don't endorse the idea that it doesn't require intelligence. I mean, but people might think that.
Yeah.
However, building a robot that could give you a haircut, it's close to impossible at the moment. I mean, maybe like a buzz cut, it can shave off all your hair or something like that if you put your head into some sort of thing. Yeah. But a normal haircut is at the moment is close to impossible. There's another one example people always use, building a robot that can fold a towel. And you know, there are lots of competitions where different companies or research teams that try to build these robots that can just fold a towel. This is a skill that's very easy for a human. So these kinds of things, and a lot of work that's requires sort of motor skills, so to speak, very hard to do. Reading a text and extracting some keywords or something like that, very easy to do for a computer program. So sometimes it's sort of when people say these kinds of things, that yes, in a few years, in 50 years, technologies are going to be able to do every single work task better than humans, then actually that is typically quite unrealistic given how hard it is for technology to do certain kinds of things. I mean, again, cutting hair or folding towels or whatever it might be. I mean, we spoke about self-driving cars. Again, about 10 years ago or so, there was the idea that within 5 years, there would be like no need for regular cars anymore. The self-driving cars would be much safer, much more efficient, better in every single way. And even some of those people working on self-driving cars back then have now they quit those jobs. They've started working on other things. It turned out to be much more difficult to have a self-driving car that can operate in a safe and effective way in human traffic. Of course, if you rebuild the streets, if you remove all the humans, if you remove all the trees, if you build a big tunnel so that the weather doesn't matter, then yes, you can have a self-driving car all day long. But if you want to also preserve maybe the beauty of our the cities we live in and the variety of different ways in which people get around on bikes and walking, etc., then it turned out that it was much, much more difficult to create a self-driving car than people thought. And so in the same, so it that just shows that it's actually quite hard to predict how quick technological development is going to be. Sometimes it's much quicker than we think, but quite often a certain subtask is being perfected by the computer program, but the sort of the broader package fitting something into human society, that's often a big challenge. And so yeah, I mean, I actually tend to agree with the comment that you made in this particular exchange, that we've had similar situations before. Okay, so some tasks and some types of work have been partly automated, but then that's often opened up other types of needs for human work and other types of I mean, the ATM machine is an interesting case, because I think one of the early developments was that actually led to more banks and more
It led to more banks,
branches being
more
opened.
employment, higher wages, everything.
Right. I mean, I wonder, however, yeah, that was how it was then. I mean, now I think maybe it's interesting to think about. I mean, since then, banking has transformed quite a bit, and because partly it's because a lot of societies. I mean, I'm from Sweden myself, and Sweden has sort of the aim of becoming completely cashless. They're not there yet, my fellow Swedes, but and that's one thing that sort of definitely changes the role of. I mean, ATMs, for example, are not going to be needed if we are in a cashless society, handling cash, etc. Anyway, so yeah, so I mean, I agree with you that. Usually, these fears about complete, loss of every kind of job, every kind of opportunities often ex are exaggerated. However, I acknowledge that I have colleagues that really think that no, this time it's different, because now the technological development is so quick, the range of things AI technologies can do is you're staggering, and so on and so forth. So there's a lot of interesting disagreement about this among the experts.
Yeah, clearly. Let me conclude by asking you a question that John Danaher has worked on, and then you discuss in depth. So, in one of his papers, he argues that about the structural badness of work, how we should already welcome a world where there's no work. It's fine, people should play and just be entertained, and there should be UBI and wide range of things. You know, that's an argument. And then there is a scenario of collaborative replacement that you talked about, that maybe we work with machines and it doesn't need to all go away. A part of it can be automated, and we can focus on things that make humans totally unique. If you combine both these views, it sort of opens up optionality for two sets of people. One who genuinely don't want to go do work. They'd like to watch Netflix, play games, because their needs are met. enjoy the sunshine, take care of their family. Like, they don't need to be involved in economic activity. For them, this is a good scenario. And for others who feel like, doing work, but not necessarily, doing all the effort themselves, machines can work with them. So is there a scenario where the combination of these two things can miss out on a moral harm that we should be aware of or keep in mind? Because it seems like it's a perfect situation where we are heading toward.
Yeah, I mean, I should absolutely. That's a great question. I mean, one thing one could add also is like that some of these people who don't want to work, it may be that what they want to do is not necessarily to, let's say, just watch Netflix or play games all day. It could also be that they want to engage in some sort of spiritual pursuit. Or they want to engage in sort of lifelong learning and study. And so the range of things, or maybe create art. Let's say so the range of things that people could want to do might be larger than I mean what I spoke about before this the Wall-E idea of people just sitting there eating and watching Netflix all day. So there's more variety there and what could open up for people. But some of them who do want to work could work with machines and maybe outsource the boring tasks the bar bits of the work and to the machines and do the more satisfying tasks. I mean, that would be a great scenario. I mean, at this particular point in time, I actually got together with some organizational psychologists, and we did a research project on this. And so we went out to some companies that are, introducing more and more technology. And at least at the moment, it does seem that, yes, for some people, typically higher up on the chain of the command, so to speak, managers, etc. They typically get more stimulating work when there's more technology in the workplace. For some of their subordinates, however, for them it's more frustrating because yes, they get support in some ways from the technologies, but they are also often, for example, not permitted to fix the technology if there's a problem because then they have to bring in some outside technician because otherwise the insurance is not going to cover things. And so for some sort of practically minded people who are doing more manual kind of work before. They're still doing manual work, but the range of different subtasks that they're doing is much smaller. And for them, it's more frustrating. Whereas for some people in other parts of the companies, it might be, interesting to have the new technology. You can experiment more, they can try out new things. And so we also have to keep in mind that for the people that are doing collaborative work with technology, there are going to be some who are the winners, namely work becomes better and more interesting, and some who maybe are not the winners, the losers, if you will, whose work now indeed they get support for technologies, but the technologies start telling them what to do, and they get fewer opportunities for creative work because otherwise the technologies are not going to work in the way they're supposed to, etc. So we shouldn't we should remember that these technological developments are going to affect people differently. And obviously, we're gonna explore ways in which technological development can promote meaningful and good work, but we should also think about for whom, for everyone, or for the lucky subset, so to speak, and what should we do with those people whose work is actually that they still have to work because humans are needed, because again, we have motor skills and things like that we have, and we outperform robots, but maybe am I now like so to speak, the servant of the robot it performs one task very well, but I have to kind of maintain it, I have to fix it, or I have to polish it, whatever. And so for some people, it's going to be better in this scenario that you describe. For some people, it's going to be not so good. And then the question would be, of course, can we compensate those people? Can we maybe give them the option of becoming one of the people who spend their days with games or I don't know, with spiritual pursuits or whatever it might be, or yeah. So, I mean, I don't work a lot on these political philosophy issues related to these things, but I do have colleagues that do that, and I've been impressed by their, pressing on me and others the need to also think about those kind of distributional aspects of like, okay, is this going to benefit just a subset or everyone, and then how can we then think about, well, if it's good for some but not for others, what is that? Can we do something about that? Is this just how it is, and its life is unfair, or What, how can we think about that? That's another thing that I think we should think about in this context.
You would stick to it that even collaborative replacement and you know these kinds of scenarios, the nature and value of achievement does change, and we should pay attention to it. You agree
Absolutely.
with
And
that? Yeah.
yeah, and also, like, you know, it could be that maybe there, I mean, it could be that there's less room for human achievement in certain lines of work. But again, that doesn't necessarily mean that other dimensional meaningful works are also, you know, go out, the, are thrown out the window, so to speak. I mean, like, because it could be, as I said before, we spoke about this idea of a practice-based idea of work, like, you know, actually being there, putting, you know, having, being all there and like, you know, having your mind not be elsewhere and like really caring about the team that you're working in, being a good colleague, etc. A lot of those things can make work meaningful as well. Of course, again, if fewer and fewer humans are your colleagues and more technologies, a chatbot, a robot, a machine, is now the thing the thing you're working with as opposed to the person you're working with, then, I mean, I actually wrote a little bit, I wrote a couple of papers about whether a robot could be a good colleague under any kind of circumstances. And actually, my collaborator, Yilis Smith, and I, we argued that yes, in certain respects, a robot could be a good colleague. It could be reliable. It could be, you know, it could support you in various kind of ways in your work. It might not bully you or things like that. But on the other hand, it could not be a good, maybe friend in the sense that a good colleague would be. It could maybe, you can't really have a human-like exchange with it. And maybe you can chat with a chatbot, but it's quite a different story than speaking with a colleague who has a life to lead. And, you know, anyway, so it's, there are lots of interesting questions also about not only achievement, but about what happens to collegiality, what happens to team spirit, so to speak, in the work team. Interestingly, I mean, maybe that's the last thing to mention, is that there are certainly people who experience the robots they're working alongside with as a kind of interesting new form of teammate. I mean, it's a little bit like when people sometimes work with work animals, with dogs or horses. I mean, they realize that this is not a colleague in the sense that a human is a colleague, but it's a member of the team, and people develop, you know, special kind of feelings for these animal members of the team. It has happened in real life that people have also developed a kind of bond. Military personnel in war zones working with bomb disposal robots is the example people always talk about. Who, you know, when the robot was blown up, in a, you know, because it went on, stepped on a landmine, that the soldiers wanted to bury it and give it a military funeral, etc. So people can develop these kinds of human-like attitudes towards technologies. And so there's a whole separate discussion in philosophy about, is that a mistake? Are these people deluded in some way, or does it make sense? So that just goes to show that in addition to these questions about, you know, what happens to human achievement when we start working, collaborating with robots and AI and technologies, there's also the issue of what happens to collegiality, what happens to the sense of working in a team, what happens to how you see yourself in relation to the other members of the workforce, etc. So that's a wide range of interesting questions that arise when we start introducing more and more technology of different sorts into the work we do.
We're almost at time. I was wondering if you had a couple of minutes to conclude, or should we wrap up now?
I guess I can conclude by then just saying that for me, these questions are all special cases of the more broad idea that as we bring in technologies that are able to do some of the things that we were doing before, the question then arises, will I stop doing that thing? You know, writing text, making decisions, making recommendations. Will I go on to do something else? Will I start collaborating with the technology and now we form a team who writes the text, who makes the recommendation, who drives the car, whatever. And so definitely, it's whenever we introduce AI and the advanced technologies, it is going to change the nature of the activities we're engaged in. And we have to think both about the opportunities, maybe there are better outcomes, but what about the work itself? Maybe we are promoting certain values in terms of, you know, things are quick, things are efficient, but are they satisfying? Do they feel meaningful for the people involved? Are they really good, you know, in a broad sense? That question always arises when we have technologies take over human tasks. And as you said, it's in a certain sense, it's nothing new. What we did with our muscles before, maybe the machines took over those tasks. Now, well, the thing that's new perhaps is that now what we were doing with our mental muscles before, our brains, our intelligence, that's also being taken over by technology. And so again, then the question is this an opportunity cost because there's nothing better for me to do? Or does it open up, free up time and opportunities for me to do other things that maybe I value more? Maybe I can engage in my lifelong learning, study, my, you know, the games I want to play, as John Danaher talks about, or something like that. So yeah, so always this question about the technology, the computer, the AI takes over something I did before. What am I going to do now? Is there something better for me to do? Or am I in a situation where I gave away maybe the task, the responsibility that mattered most to me or to my fellow human beings? So that's, for me, that's the question that then is specified in different ways in all of these different self-driving cars, generative AI, you know, I mean, the hair cutting robot, we're not going to get that in a while, but, you know, at some point we might have it. Anyway, so yeah, that's the thing that for me ties everything together.
And I know philosophers are not in the business of giving advice per se, but if you were pushed to give advice to young people or students who are thinking about artificial intelligence and philosophy and society, do you have any important questions or ideas they want to think about?
Well, I mean, I guess I will give you, my general thing is that I would say is that think both about the very concrete technical problem that you might be working on, but, you know, don't forget to sometimes also zoom out and look at the, you know, the technology from a broader point of view. And actually a lot of universities that teach computer scientists, engineers, etc., all over the world, I mean, they are starting to also offer courses in, you know, the ethics, the philosophy of technology, whether it's MIT in the US, for example, they have done this for a long time. Some of those universities that I worked at before, like in Eindhoven in the Netherlands, all the students have to take an ethics course. And so I think, I mean, actually a lot of people in the tech world, not everyone, but a lot of the well-known people, I mean, they are starting to talk about these things. And I think in general, as humans, I mean, we don't only have to focus on one thing. We can focus on our complete problems for day to day, but, you know, it's also valuable and important to zoom out, look at things in a broader context and see, is this really benefiting us? Or is it also by solving one problem, maybe I'm creating two new other problems? And so, yeah. So thinking about the overall costs and benefits of the new technologies we're developing, I think is something we should do in addition to just solving the concrete, you know, first practical problems that we maybe are trying to solve with those new technologies.
Thank you so much, Sven. I thoroughly appreciate your time, and I look forward to having you back on Network Capital soon.
Thanks for having me. Thank you very much.